Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is one of the featured speakers for the upcoming John Hope Franklin National Symposium on Reconciliation in America. This year's theme is Education for Reconciliation, and my guest has been instrumental in creating opportunities for underrepresented groups in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM for short. Dr. Freeman Hrabowski III is a mathematician and president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. During his long tenure at the school, the institution has transformed from an obscure commuter school into a research institution recognized as one of the most innovative in the country. From a very diverse student body, over half of UMBC's graduates each year leave with a degree in STEM fields. Hrabowski is the co-author of two books, Beating the Odds, Raising Academically Successful African-American Males, and a sequel for Young Women. And he is also chair of the prestigious National Academies Committee that produced the report, Expanding Underrepresented Minority Participation, America's Science and Technology Talent at the Crossroads. In 2012, President Barack Obama appointed Hrabowski to chair the newly created President's Advisory Commission on Educational Excellence for African Americans, and he was also a candidate for the Secretary of Education in his administration. He's been called one of America's best leaders and one of America's 10 best college presidents. He is a forceful advocate for STEM education, and he'll be one of the featured speakers at the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation's 5th National Symposium on May 29th and 30th here in Tulsa. You can learn more about the symposium at jhfcenter.org. Freeman Hrabowski joins us today by phone. Freeman Hrabowski, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
One of the central tenets of your career in teaching has been boosting the number of American science, technology, engineering, and mathematics graduates, or STEM graduates, and especially graduates of underrepresented groups, and that includes everything from ethnic groups like African Americans, Hispanics, but also women as well. Given all the talk about globalization and increased competition, why does it remain difficult for most institutions to attract potential students to the STEM fields?
Actually, I was very surprised several years ago when I chaired a committee for the National Academies of Sciences looking at this question. We had assumed we were not getting students coming to college with an interest in science and engineering, but it turns out we have far more students with an interest in these areas than we might expect from all races and groups. The problem is that the vast majority of students who come to college with the intention of majoring in a STEM area, in science or engineering, will not make it, will not succeed in those areas and graduate with a bachelor's degree. In fact, over two-thirds of the students who begin college with a major in STEM will leave it within the first year or two. And so the big question is not about whether people come with an interest, but rather how do we help more students succeed? Now, the first response is, well, it's a K-12 problem. Well, it's true we want to strengthen what happens in K-12, but the fact is that even among well-prepared students of all races, we find that large numbers will not do well in the first year of science, will not get at least B's in those courses, and therefore change their majors. So much of what my own research focuses on, much of what we've been doing at my university, the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC, is to figure out ways of being much more effective in working with students once they're here to ensure that if we accepted them in those majors, they've got a good chance of actually making it in those fields.
So I want to talk about that idea that two-thirds of the students that enter STEM transfer or change majors. Is there a sense that in a lot of science and technology schools, there's a weeding process that goes out where I think the profession itself tends to say, okay, if you can't get Calculus 1, you can't go any further. Instead of saying, okay, let's figure out how to help you pass Calculus 1, the tendency is to say, well, if you can't get through Calculus 1, you can't get through thermodynamics and other things that come down the road further. Do you feel like that
Sure.
is a situation?
Well, you know, I've been asked that question often, and having been a mathematician now for 40 years, I've been thinking about what happens in mathematics. And what I would say in math and science and engineering, it's not that faculty purposely don't want people to make it. I think it is the culture of our disciplines that will lead to most people not succeeding. We actually call, many people call the first year of science and engineering weed-out courses. and the approach that's taken leads to, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Most people don't make it. Everything from not encouraging communication and collaboration among students to grading on a curve, which kind of pits one student against another, to the fact that in many institutions you've got a cutthroat mentality about not making sure you don't help each other out, to not having opportunities for more supplemental work to prepare for tests. All these things tend to lead to many students not doing well, to the university not having taken enough time to understand what background is needed for that student to have a reasonable chance of succeeding. When we have redesigned courses on my campus at UMBC and in the University System of Maryland, the goal has been to teach students how to work collaboratively, how to use technology, how to not give them the theories, but help them struggle in determining the theories themselves, for example, in the first year of chemistry, and, quite frankly, more opportunities for evaluation of their work and for chances to improve what they understand along the way, understanding that this work is sequentially based. If you don't get the first half of a course, it's really hard to go ahead and do well in the second half. And that's true in math and science and engineering. What I want people who are not in math and science to remember is the experience they had in elementary school when studying longhand division. If you think back, anybody who was learning longhand division had to first know their multiplication tables and subtraction. And it would be really hard to learn to do longhand division if they didn't already know how to multiply and subtract. And that's the point about things being sequentially based, that higher-level math and science and engineering will require strong foundations in that basic work, whatever it is. And so if the student has barely made it out of Calculus 1, for example, it's really difficult for that student to succeed in Calculus 2. And so we need to be thinking about ways of helping students to strengthen their background so that they can succeed in those classes, whether they start with the first semester of calculus or second or third semester. The point is, the work they do in that first course, whatever it is, will determine in large part how successful or how unsuccessful they will be in the subsequent work.
Now, is that the role for the K-12 education, or is that more a role for higher education as they take these students in?
It's a role for both. K-12, clearly. I mean, I think teachers know that what happens in pre-algebra has a substantial background of what will happen in algebra. You can't do algebra if you haven't had that strong pre-algebra background. The Common Core standards will be building one topic on top of another in terms of concepts, but similarly at the college level. But what most people will say is, well, they just didn't have the strong high school background. Let me give you one statistic that will surprise you and it surprises most people. If you look at some of the research at UCLA involving performance in science, the fact is that the higher the SAT or ACT of a student, the larger the number of AP credits in STEM areas, the more prestigious the university the person attends, often the greater the probability the student will not succeed in science, which is counterintuitive. You think, well, if they had high test scores and high grades and AP courses, of course they're going to do well. Well, the majority of those students who go to the most prestigious of universities in the country end up changing their majors within the first year or two. Now, they may not tell you they changed it because they didn't do well, because who wants to say, I bummed out of this course? They would simply, as a rule, refer to the area in which they are transferring, to which they transfer, because that's the area in which they're making higher grades, and that would be an area outside of science and engineering. People who have been through this experience always shake their heads when I say this. They know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And I think that gets to another tenet of what you try to pass on to your students, is that any degree is going to take a lot of hard work, no matter your talent level. Is that play a big role in what you're talking about?
It very much so. And I am a strong believer that students should pursue their passion, whether it's in the arts or the humanities, social sciences, or natural sciences and engineering. In any of those areas, to be the best, one has to work very hard. I think what makes STEM coursework more different than most is that you have to be in that class every day, usually, and work every day to keep up with it. In some of the other disciplines, if one can read and write well, even if you don't stay up with the work, you can catch up because you know how to study or you know how to read and think and write well. If you're in my math class and you miss 3 or 4 days, it's not enough to just get the notes, because it usually you have to be there in order to be able to really catch the meaning, to understand and grasp the concept. And so it is a matter, I like to say, we say on our campus, you have to marry this work and be there every day for dinner working on it. Very important. You cannot be away from it for a week and think to come back and you're going to be okay.
Well, I want to talk about the experience at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, because during your time there, the campus is utterly transformed from a small commuter school to now a nationally known science engineering school that I think over 50% of your graduates from a very diverse student body are in STEM fields. How did you go about making that transformation take place?
Well, we've always had some excellent faculty members, and it is interesting that we do have a large percentage in science and engineering. I will start by saying that we have strong liberal arts broadly, so that we have students who are superb in the humanities and the arts and social sciences, and many will connect disciplines in science and engineering to the other disciplines. But most important, culture change has to do with people looking at the data to see what's going on. And what we saw here was that large numbers of students of all races were not succeeding in science and engineering, and we needed to understand why. And the first reaction is always, well, the students aren't working hard, or they don't have the background. And while those may be some of the factors, it was great to see faculty willing to say, well, what might we do to get students even more engaged in the work, to make expectations even clearer, to find ways of using best practices around the country that can help more of our students succeed. And this is when we got to talking about building community among the students, and we looked at the group that tends to be at the bottom. Those would be underrepresented groups, blacks and Hispanics. And what we said was, if we could help that group succeed, we could learn things that might help large numbers of my white students succeed, who had come from better backgrounds, stronger backgrounds, academically stronger backgrounds. And that's exactly what has happened. We did experiment with a variety of practices that focused on teaching students how to help each other, that looked at ways of getting students involved in research much sooner, that encouraged faculty to look at the analytics to understand trends in performance in different classes, and then in more recent years, faculty decided they really did want to focus on redesigning courses in order to make the courses more effective in working with all kinds of students. And so we have courses at the Chemistry Discovery Center. If somebody looks on the UMBC website at the Chemistry Discovery Center, you'll see students working in groups of four using technology, with each student having a defined role, such as project manager or the scribe for the group, and where students are struggling and arguing and laughing and working to solve problems together. And what has happened is that we've had a substantially large gain in the students earning at least B's in these courses, and that's students of all races. In fact, we've become the leading predominantly white university in sending blacks on to science PhDs and MD PhDs.
So give us a sense of how you have done some of these redesigns. You mentioned the Chemistry Center, but what are some of the other strategies to get the students that are retaining this information in a marginal sort of way, which sets them up for failure as you continue this sort of systematic learning in science and technology fields, to actually mastering it and being able to be successful?
Sure. This is giving faculty opportunities for professional development to take the release time necessary to look at best practices in a chemistry course, to propose changes in the course which would focus on a de-emphasis on the lecture part and an emphasizing of students working in groups, redesigning curriculum materials, looking at the testing, and ensuring that the rigor is what we would expect based on the American Chemical Society. It takes time for faculty to have the opportunity to think through how this can best be done. And then we piloted that course the first year of chemistry. We've now moved on to the second year. But we've also piloted courses in other STEM areas. And we flipped a lot of courses, having more emphasis on giving students a chance to try things on their own first and to use videos and using online approaches for hybrid courses, and then having faculty base their work with students on what students can't understand themselves or where they've gotten misguided, rather than starting from the beginning, going into a lecture, opening somebody's head, pouring in the knowledge from a set of lecture notes, and then testing them on the material. So it's a much more interactive, iterative process now in a number of the courses.
Now, one of the things University of Maryland, Baltimore County has done is you have this Meyerhoff Scholarship Program, which is offers comprehensive tutoring and help, financial aid, but it was originally, I guess, designed for African-American males to become science and engineers, and I think it's expanded to include all races and both genders.
Yep.
And I've seen the 60 Minutes piece that featured them during the summer. You bring them in the summer before, and it's almost like an academic boot camp to get them ready.
Yeah, it's evolved to that. It started, though, because Bob Meyerhoff, who is a wonderful Jewish philanthropist, was interested in this question. Why is it that everything he saw on TV about black males was negative except for athletics? And he said, what could we do to strengthen education for those students? Because he understood that they were a part of society. So it was really his vision in thinking that way and our concern about the fact that so many minority students were not succeeding in science. We married the two ideas, and we came up with this program for young black males. Some people didn't like the fact that we had a program only for males, but black women were very pleased that we did because of the need to see more of that group actually succeeding, since women among African Americans are doing better academically than men. After that first year, we brought in women, black women, and then after a number of years, we decided to open the program to students of all races who have an interest in strengthening what happens with underrepresented groups. That's whether we're talking about first-generation college, students with certain racial backgrounds, people with first-generation college. And as time has gone on, we have continued to revise the program to have it evolving. And what you saw on TV on 60 Minutes really is a result of what we've learned about structure and an old-fashioned approach. You know, people are surprised to see it, but we have learned that if you really want to get that group working together, we actually take some of the technology away from them so they're not simply texting and on phones with friends back home, but rather focus on that group and on the work there. And these are practices that students recommended based on their own experiences. How do you get people to work together? Well, you got to get them to stop thinking about the friends from the high school and from other people and to focus on each other, on the strength of that group and building synergy among that group. And most important, though, we really do believe they have to learn how to follow instructions. To be creative, yeah, but to follow instructions and to develop the level of discipline and hard work necessary for success.
Mm. Now, this sounds like some of these themes could be used to transform K through 12 STEM teaching.
I think so in many ways, particularly building community among students, having students help each other. We have a lot of K through 12 programs here at the university, and they focus on having older students working with younger students, teaching students in math and science how to explain concepts with clarity, giving teachers a chance to rethink their approach to introducing the work to students. So, no, I do think there is a need for very strong relationships between K through 12 and universities, pre-K through 12 and universities.
My guest today is Freeman Hrabowski, president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He'll be one of the featured speakers at the 5th Annual John Hope Franklin National Symposium on Reconciliation in America. This year's theme is Education for Reconciliation. That takes place May 29th and 30th here in our city. And he joins us today by phone from the campus of University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Well, earlier you said something which I think gets back to that idea of the weeding out process, and I think you also addressed this in a New York Times interview in which you said, you know, a lot of times when kids are in the math class, maybe in the science class, and they're having trouble even at a young age, maybe we're talking high school, middle school, the tendency is the teacher will say, you know, I'll help you get through this, but science and math is not for you. You don't, and you said earlier, you don't have the background. And how important is this in pushing people away from STEM fields?
I think it's a very important point. I said something like that to about 1,000 math teachers, and some agreed with me, others did not. But I've been looking at this for 40 years. We in America tend to think that math and science are only for a few people. Most Americans tend to feel that way. When I ask American audiences how many of them knew by the time they were in the 11th grade that they were either a math science type or a history, English, and arts type, most people raised their hands. They had been made to feel that way. When I asked them how did they know, usually they would say, well, I was just better in this other area, or I was more interested in the other area, without even realizing that they'd come to that conclusion because of a lot of circumstances, including impressions given by teachers, including the way we sometimes look at students. Because we may not look at a student and then say, you're not a math science type, but the look sometimes tells a kid, well, I'll help you right now, but let's not come back next year. I don't expect to be in there next year. And then in other cases, quite frankly, counselors and others will suggest to students they go into one path rather than another. And everybody means well, but we're all the products of our childhood experiences. And we, again, in America, tend to think that math and science are not for most students. I would argue that many more Americans could succeed in math and science, whether they wanted to be a mathematician, a scientist, or an engineer. We all need a stronger background in statistics, for example. According to Common Core standards, we'll talk about that. We need the information, the quantitative skills to evaluate information as citizens. But we've done very little as a country, in my opinion, to help students feel that they can succeed in these disciplines.
I want to ask you a sort of a tough question based on that, and that is the idea that if we have teachers that are pushing students away, given our underrepresented population, how much is cultural bias playing a role in that?
Well, and you know, and when you said it, I cringe because I don't think teachers mean to push people away so much.
No.
But I do think that what happens is students can be sometimes not interested and not work hard. And to be fair to the teacher is saying, well, how much can I do? And that's always a challenge. I think the culture is such, though, that a kid will grow up, a minority kid, for example, will grow up thinking, I want to be a football player, because the society, first of all, says if you're a football player or you're a basketball player, you're like an American Idol. You know, we don't do that with people who are for being really well educated, and we certainly don't do it for kids who are great in math and science. And so we have to think about what happens in our society that either encourages people or discourages them from going into certain areas. Then you couple that with the fact that we need families really helping their kids to know more about hard work and studying and supporting the teachers as they try to help these children. And then finally, when you get to the issue of minorities and women, you'd be surprised how we as a society really don't encourage girls to go into certain areas. I'll give you one, probably the most glaring example in 2014 involves girls and technology. We have gone from 35-36% of our computer science majors in America being women down to half that, to 18%. In the past 30 years, and it has to do with our attitudes about technology and boys versus girls. So that in an area like that, you'll find in high school and in college, we don't encourage them to move on. I mean, it's a major issue. It really is. And most important, I will tell you that amazingly, the young women that I see who start in their freshman year will go into classes where you don't have enough people who are other young women, and as a result, they can get discouraged. And so sometimes the professor doesn't realize that what he says or doesn't say can either push a young woman away, or if you have very few minorities there and they're not accustomed to being in those classes, before you know it, unfortunately, you've got a problem because the students are feeling they really shouldn't be in those situations.
Let's talk about the recommendations from that National Academies Committee you chaired on expanding minority participation in science and technology. You had there were a number of recommendations, but two urgent ones. And the first one was basically retaining the students you already have in STEM because, as you mentioned, that so over two-thirds will change their major out of STEM during their career. And the second was transforming K-12 STEM teaching. What were the takeaways from this as far as the best things, the best practices you can do to aid both of those recommendations?
I would say number one, strengthen undergrad education in science and engineering. Give universities incentives to have larger numbers of students whom they admit actually succeed in science and engineering. and give students at the undergrad level a chance to have research experiences so they can begin to dream about the possibilities and consider careers in those areas and connect the universities to employers, to companies, to see how science and engineering can strengthen the economy and help, whether it's about tech company or an IT company or in the health profession or in energy or in the environment. And then for the K-12 situation, we really need to strengthen middle school education, because many of those teachers need support because they don't have a major in math and science. And yet, more and more, we expect middle school students to learn algebra, for example. So strengthening the skills of teachers starting at the middle school level particularly would be very important. And then a fundamental point for children beginning all the way pre-K on, strong reading skills are critical. People don't realize that we don't discuss science and math in numbers. We discuss those disciplines using language, and that means that we really need to strengthen the reading and thinking skills of all children.
Now, you're going to be addressing the John Hope Franklin Symposium on Reconciliation. The theme is Education for Reconciliation. How can addressing these, you know, the 2006 study where underrepresented minority percentage of the population is over a quarter of the population, yet those in science and technology jobs is less than 10%. How can that help address overall racial reconciliation in America?
First of all, I'm honored to say that Dr. Franklin was a mentor of mine, and I had wonderful quality time with him during his period at Duke, and we were corresponding all the time, and I'm close to his son, and I know how proud he was to come from your part of the country. Let me just say that, from my perspective, we in universities and in K-12 have to help students and adults learn to listen to each other more carefully and to put ourselves in the shoes of other people if we're going to find ways of connecting in substantive ways. It's very important that we teach people that in an argument, the point is not simply to win, but to seek the truth and to gain an understanding of other perspectives and to find strategies and approaches that can be most effective in pulling people together as we solve problems, as we work to reach goals. Our goal should be to educate children of all races and to teach them how to work with each other, because it's only in working together that we become a stronger country.
You know, and of course, as you well know from the science and technology fields, working together collaboratively is a part of any job in the profession these days.
That's exactly right. And if you're going to have people from all over the world working in our country, we need people who know how to work with these people with the different backgrounds, with different cultural perspectives, and listening to the perspectives of others will be a very important part of it. And then developing the language skills to be understood clearly and to be willing to empathize with people from different situations, whether people from low-income backgrounds or people who've not had certain advantages.
All right. Well, President Hrabowski, we look forward to your remarks at the symposium later this month, May 29th and 30th here in Tulsa. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Freeman Hrabowski III is the president of the University of Maryland at Baltimore County and one of the featured speakers for this year's John Hope Franklin National Symposium on Reconciliation in America. The theme for this year's symposium, taking place May 29th and 30th in Tulsa, is Education for Reconciliation. For more information, visit jhfcenter.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. You can look for Studio Tulsa and look for our most recent programs or search through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.